Welcome to Grounded Wellness, your go-to podcast for simplified and trusted information on how to live a more non-toxic and holistic life. We're your hosts. I'm Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, biohacking enthusiast and mom of three.
And I'm Courtney O'Connor, holistic esthetician with over 15 years experience in the healing power of touch and holistic skincare rituals.
A woman's intuition should never be overlooked or underestimated, especially when it comes to pregnancy and birth. That's why I'm so excited to welcome our guest, Lindsay Mielis. Lindsay is a widely renowned midwife in Southern California. She uses a combination of ancestral wisdom along with her own experience and expertise to hold space for birthing experiences that are sacred and transformative. In this episode, we discuss the importance of animal protein for a healthy mom and baby, why hospital births often lead to a cascade of interventions, and healing from birth trauma. Lindsay will forever change your outlook on birth. Let's dig in. Hello and welcome to another episode of Grounded Wellness. We are here at the farm set. We're barefoot, we're grounding, we're drinking liver smoothies, doing all the things, and we have Lindsay Mielis here. We are going to have a conversation all about pregnancy, birth, and postpartum, and you are the perfect person to have it with. So thank you so much for being here today.
Yay. Thank you, guys. It's so good to be here with both of you. I'm really honored.
Okay, we're going to jump right into it. We know that fertility rates are declining at a staggering rate right now in the U.S. They have been for several years. What, in your opinion, are the biggest contributors to this all-time low in fertility?
Yeah, I don't think that people realize how staggering these rates actually are. So what's estimated right now is that our infertility is increasing at about 1% per year. So if you actually calculate that out, it's really not that many years, if we really go by that statistic, that we have a chance of fertility for our children, for our grandchildren. If we look at our grandparents, maybe our parents, the boomer generation, our birth rate is 50% lower right now in 2024 than it was during the boomer generation. We can look at the statistics from 2000 to 2020, and there was a 25% drop in birth rates just in that time frame. So these are very concerning. We have to look at all the different factors that factor into this, because we know right now that 25% of women are burdened with PCOS, which is one of the leading causes of infertility. We know that 25% of men under the age of 40 are struggling with erectile dysfunction. So many of these things are contributing to us being able to not get pregnant. First things first, let's look at plastics. Microplastics are talked about so much right now in the news and all of the health podcasts that we're listening to. But I don't think that people really understand the magnitude of why these microplastics are affecting us so much. So the inception of using plastic in our industrialized nation was in the early 1900s. There's 8 billion metric tons of microplastics in our oceans, in our air, in our soil right now. For placentas that are being tested right now, it's 100% of placentas that have microplastics in them.
100%.
100% in these research studies across the board, not just one, across the board. We find these microplastics in the umbilical cord. We're finding microplastics now in our brains. They estimate that 0.5% of our brain matter is made up of microplastics. Gosh. This isn't good. Microplastics create a chemical reaction within our bodies that cause an excess of estrogen. When we look right now at testosterone rates, the average 25-year-old male in 2024 has the same testosterone rate of a 70-year-old in the year 2000. This isn't that long ago, you guys. All of these implications are having huge effects on our fertility. I know that there's all these different like algaes that they're looking into with getting rid of the microplastics in our oceans. And there's like the human vacuum that they're using. There's an island floating around in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know how big it is, but it's huge. It's just made up of plastic. So we need to start getting these plastics out. And what we also need to look at is what we're spraying on our foods. So we use chemicals in our foods that actually require people to be in hazmat suits as they're spraying them. Okay. If someone's in a hazmat suit, how is that safe for human consumption? We use atrazine, which is a chemical that most of the world doesn't use. We buy most of it from China. And this astaxanthin actually goes in and it creates a xeno effect within our bodies that reduces the testosterone and creates this excess estrogen. So we know now that the menstruation age of little girls has gone down. Our grandparents, the average rate was anywhere from 12 to 15 years for menstruation when we get our periods, the onset of menarche. When we look at it now, the average age is about 10 years old. I hear stories from kindergarten teachers that have to keep menstruation pads in their classroom in case they have abnormal vaginal bleeding, which is a period from kindergartners. These statistics are horrifying. They actually have a 20% increase of developing breast cancer opposed to someone who starts their period after the age of 13.
Gosh.
That's not good.
Because of all the excess estrogen?
Because of all the excess estrogen. We know that these kids are more likely to have obesity problems. We know that these kids are more likely to have type 2 diabetes, that onset, the pre-diabetic state. So we need to do something, and we need to move away from all of these microplastics. We need to move away from the conventional food industry. Right now, it's really in the spotlight. A lot of people are talking about this. We are one of the unhealthiest nations on the planet right now. The world health isn't even that great, but the United States has no regulations for these things. Every year, there's 70 billion tons of this astaxanthin that's sprayed all over the food supply. So we need to make sure that we start changing and selecting with our pocketbooks what's most important for our families and for our children. The number one thing that's bought right now with food stamps is all the sodas, the Pepsis, the Cokes. One of my favorite brands that was clean, didn't use seed oils, just got bought out by Pepsi. So we have these different alternatives, but then somebody comes in like a big Pepsi, whoever, and has a $2 billion check that they present. So we need to find a way that we can still keep all of our small, sustainable foods intact for our children. One of the best ways to do this is from a farmer's market. We know that just the transportation of citrus fruits can lose up to 50% of the vitamin C potency if it's driven across. We know that just the sun of where we're at actually has codes that are specific to where you live that benefits our bodies from eating the locally grown foods. So there's so many different things that we can look at. But first things first, let's get the chemicals out. We need to look at organizations like Moms Across America. We need to look at Robert F. Kennedy's information that's coming out right now. Callie and Casey Means are speaking out about this. These are the people that we need to be turning to within our administration to actually say, like, hey, let's make a change here for our future generations.
And so, Lindsay, with the conversation around like pesticides being sprayed and all the chemicals on our food, and obviously as well seeping into our soil and soil health, which is what we're really prioritizing here on our regenerative farm, can you speak more about the standard American diet as a whole and how that's impacting reproductive health?
So one of my favorite doctors, Dr. Zach Bush, talks so much about the importance of the soil.
Yes.
He estimates that there's about 40 to 60 harvests left if we continue to go at the rate that we're going right now with all of the chemicals that we're spraying in our foods and without the biodiversity within the farming systems. 40 to 60 harvests is not a lot. So what we need to do is get back into our soil. We need to come up with creative solutions, which so many people are doing right now. And if we bring back all of those minerals into our soil, then what's going to happen is those minerals are going to come back into our food supply, opposed to the standard American diet, which really is just eating out of a box. Nothing's alive. It's full of chemicals. And so, you know, bring our kids to places like this. Like, let them get their hands in the soil. Let them understand that, like, the food actually comes from here and that it's picked, that they have to tend the soil. They have to water the soil. They have to water all of the vegetables. They have to, you know, till the land. Like, it, there's a whole piece that's missing right now with our children that don't even know where food comes from.
Yeah, you touch on, so kids' food. And, you know, that happens to be a lot of the food that children eat, is this dead food that you're describing.
Yes.
I may get judged about this by some people, but there are so many foods that I do not allow my kids to have, and I don't see that as extreme because I don't see that food as food.
Yeah, it's not.
So in my opinion, like, the world is changing. What kids and what people are eating has changed. Like, my view of what food is hasn't changed, you know, since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But it's seen as extreme to stay away from these, like, food-like products by the general population, because that's just what we've become so accustomed to, which is really sad, I think.
It's so sad. It's so sad. And now I'm on the flip side of it. So I have teenagers. Mm-hmm. And so I can see, like, there's only so much I can control. Like, if they're at a friend's house, I can't control what they're eating. If they're out riding their bikes, I can't control what they're eating. And really, teenagers are supposed to be a little bit defiant to find their sense of self. So what I found is that both my teenagers, they were both raised organic. They were both breastfed for a very long time. They were, you know, they had the foundations of this optimal health. And now that they're out in the world, it's kind of like, oh, like, how do I find my own footing? And so I always say, you're so lucky you had the foundation of good health in your early years.
Yeah, now they know the difference.
And I know they'll come back to it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yes, they'll probably get a bag of Doritos at a friend's house. Mm-hmm. But when they come home, we make our own food. We sit around the dinner table together, and they still have that foundation that's there. And hopefully that foundation will continue to follow through into their, you know, continuation of the rest of their life, into their own families, and hopefully into their children's lives as well. So I want to talk about other harmful chemicals that we need to really look at. And, you know, this is a shameful plug for your company, because we know that what we put on our skin is something that's really important that we look at as well. We know the VOCs in air freshener, in our fabric softener, in perfumes are all huge endocrine disruptors. Mm-hmm. So not are we just looking at our soils, our foods, reducing the amount of plastics, what's going into our bodies, but also what's going on our bodies. And I think that's just a really important piece to weave in to making sure that people understand that's a huge piece of fertility.
One of our functions of our skin is absorption.
Of course.
And so it truly does impact our internal and overall health.
Yeah, what research shows is that children are actually 30% more at risk to all of those VOCs, fragrances, because they're smaller. And so their bodies don't have the processing to get rid of them as fast as adults do. Not that it's good for adults either, but like 30 times more likely to have an effect from all of those fragrances and bad chemicals that we're putting onto our skin, all the shampoos, all of the conditioners, all of that. So that's a really important thing to make sure that we weave out of our households.
Yeah, we're really being inundated on so many levels with these toxins. Yeah. And it can feel overwhelming, but I always try to say, like, see it as an opportunity. All of these things are opportunities of areas that you can address and make changes. And any change you make, it's going to be beneficial, and you can go about it at whatever pace you're able to, whatever pace feels comfortable. But the more knowledge you have, the more you know what you can tackle and what you can kind of set to the side for the time being and then kind of get to eventually. It's hard nowadays because there are just so many toxins everywhere and so little regulation to protect us from this stuff. And I think it happens. I think change can happen on two levels, from the regulatory side and also from this place of taking ownership of your future, ownership of your health, ownership of your children's health. Like, you do have a say. We all have a say.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears and chat about animal-based protein because I know you're big on this.
Yes.
And I am too. It's something that I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
What do you see as being the role of animal-based protein in preconception and pregnancy?
It's the foundation for health. So not only is it the foundation for the baby's health, but it's the foundation for this mother that needs to continue to be healthy for the rest of her life to raise these children. And so we have to think of it as one of the most essential pieces of something that we talk about with somebody that's either in preconception or in the pregnancy state, because it is all of the amino acids, it's all of the minerals, it's everything that's coming in a dense state. So we're not getting all of these fillers with things that are in a box. We're actually getting nutrient-dense foods that go into the mom's body. We're building our blood supply in pregnancy. Between 20 to 28 weeks, a mother's blood supply actually doubles during that time. Wow. In anticipation for losing the blood at postpartum. But if we don't have that sustained nutrition, if we don't have those building blocks that are in place, moms are going to become severely anemic. And making sure that you're getting enough protein, it prevents so much of nowadays. I feel like there's all of these iron shortages because women are so, the human race is so anemic because we're not getting those nutrient-rich foods. Our soils are so depleted of the iron that we're not getting it through our Cracker Jack boxes. All of our fortified foods, we know that the fortified foods are full of all of these different sorts of vitamins that aren't broken down for the majority of the population. We promote folic acid. Well, the general population promotes folic acid. And what we really should be promoting is making sure that women are getting folate from food. If you need to supplement during that first trimester to minimize neurotube defects, then it should be from a methylated folate source. Most people have never even heard of what a methylated folate is, but it's a food source. It's not something that's synthetically compounded in a laboratory. So one of my favorite studies that came out with protein was from a doctor in the 70s. His name was Dr. Brewer. If you've ever taken a Bradley childbirth class, Dr. Brewer is talked about all the time. And what his studies showed is that he worked in a very low income area. And what he realized is that so many of these women were having issues with preeclampsia. Preeclampsia is a condition in pregnancy where we have a dysfunction within the liver, but then we start to see blood pressures go up. So if a blood pressure goes up prenatally, then that can be many different risk factors to mom, seizures, it's restricted fetal growth. I mean, we usually, if moms start to have high blood pressure, we induce those babies and get those babies out. It's not a healthy foundation for baby to continue to grow in. Even if moms are 32 weeks pregnant, these babies are usually induced out. And what Dr. Brewer noticed is just by even getting the cheapest protein in, and what he found that to be was dairy. Like they could take their food stamps and go get a gallon of milk and some eggs and some cheeses and some cottage cheeses. What Dr. Brewer's research showed is that just by getting a minimum of 80 to 120 grams of protein per day, he studied 25,000 women. Not one of them had preeclampsia.
Stop.
Not one of them.
I'm like on the edge of my seat right now because I have a good friend that has had preeclampsia with both of her children, and she's on this journey now of, like, she was told might not be a good idea to have more kids, and she's pregnant again now. And she's, I think she's kind of found some of what you're describing in her own research as well. But that's just so fascinating. So protein.
So protein is like the biggest piece of the puzzle. But like, and if somebody comes to me and they're like, I had hypertension, I had preeclampsia last pregnancy, they're my favorite. I'm like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is what we're going to start with. Like, you need to make sure that once you're feeling better out of the first trimester, because I'm also realistic. I understand that women, if I tell them to eat 120 grams of protein in the first trimester, most of them look at me like you're insane. So once you start feeling better, we're going to start prioritizing nutrient-dense protein foods throughout the rest of your pregnancy. We need to do a food journal. What are you eating right now on a regular basis? I don't want you to add more protein, and I want you to see what your daily average is right now for protein. If you're 50 grams of protein per day, we're going to have to work really hard to make sure that you get that protein number up. Once we get that protein number up, we also have to look at what's supporting your liver. There's tons of herbs that we can use that are so simple to acquire that can support your liver throughout the pregnancy.
And what does that have to do with preeclampsia?
So what that has to do with preeclampsia is it actually keeps the liver in balance. The liver gets very taxed in pregnancy. So if we're getting enough protein, we're keeping the liver happy. It's functioning. The gallbladder is functioning well. The bile's in the gallbladder are functioning well. All of everything's moving through all the duct system, the liver, all of that filtration system. Because our bodies know that we want to make sure that we're filtering things out to keep our babies healthy. So if we're supporting our liver, then our body's going to be operating in a much more synergistic way.
Okay. So just overall, that's important during pregnancy.
Overall, for everybody, it's really important. Another thing is salt. Why?
Yes, minerals.
Why salt?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yes. So the easiest thing, I could go to literally a village in one of the poorest places in the world and bring salt, and it would change the outcomes of their pregnancy.
Wow.
I have a really good friend that works in Bali in Indonesia, and she's like, Lindsay, like sometimes all they can eat per day is like a handful of rice. That's all their family can afford. And she's done this amazing thing where behind her birth center, she's made this regenerative farm and people can come and garden and they can get free vegetables and herbs. And, you know, they can take whatever protein they can to sustain them with that their family can't afford. But salt. Salt is so easy. It's so simple. And I'm not talking Morton's table salt. Yeah. That's junk. Yeah. That's iodized junk. I'm talking sea salts, the pink Himalayan salts. I know there's all these new things right now online with what salt's best and what, but like, if you have food stamps, go to the store and get sea salt. Like, I don't care what the brand is. It's going to be better than nothing. If you can be picky with your sea salts, then go ahead and find the best one. I love Icelandic salt. It's one of the best ones out there. I've been to Iceland. I see the quality of everything there. But it's so simple. Like a minimum of 80 to 100 grams of protein every single day. Make sure you're getting enough salt in. you can put a little bit of salt in every glass of water that you drink. You don't want it to taste like salt water. It just gives you those minerals for that time being.
And that's exactly what my friend is doing.
Yes.
More protein and more salt and minerals.
So simple.
Yeah. Keep us posted on
it. I will.
She'll do fine.
Wow.
Yeah. She'll do fine. So what we know is that by increasing our protein intake, just making sure that that simple thing, there's going to be an increase with the blood volume. If the blood volume increases at an optimal range, that 50%, that doubling of the blood volume, the placenta is going to function at a much better place. This means that there's going to be a huge reduction, not just as with the preeclampsia and all these things we've just talked about. This is going to be a healthier baby. Mm-hmm. The Brewer babies are typically always over 8 pounds. These are healthy, sustainable babies. Now, we don't want a 12-pound baby. That's metabolic dysfunction. That means mom hasn't regulated her blood sugars throughout the pregnancy. But these good, you know, hearty 8-pound babies, that tells me right away that mom's had good nutrition throughout the pregnancy.
What differences have you seen in the placenta and how the placenta looks in moms that eat meat versus moms that don't?
Mm-hmm. So I had a viral video that went out that was comparing. I was recording one day and I just happened to have a client that was vegetarian for most of her life. She was vegetarian throughout most of her pregnancy until she started craving meat, which I encouraged her, but then her iron levels dropped significantly. So I said, if you can just do one thing, let's just start getting in some beef organs. Let's just start getting some liver into your diet every single day. So by the third trimester, she was consuming about 6 liver capsules per day.
Of desiccated
okay. liver. And
I was going to say, that's a big leap to go from vegetarian to like actually eating liver.
Yeah, no, she was doing the capsules. And so we got her iron levels up, which was really great. But she had basically a lifetime of being depleted from all of these different minerals that are in a more plant or a more carnivore-based diet. So what happened was she gave birth and she had this placenta, and while she did have the liver capsules at the end, there was a lot of calcification. It didn't look as healthy compared to the other mom that gave birth. It was like full carnivore and eating, you know, 80 to 100 grams of protein every single day, which was thick. And the color was different. It was like
more robust.
Deep red. It was more robust. You could see side by side that these placentas looked different. And so, you know, I hated the controversy that came from it because it did seem dogmatic. Like, it felt like in the snips, it was me saying, like, if you eat vegetarian, this is what your placenta is going to come out looking like. And if you eat meat-based, this is what your placenta is going to come out looking like. No, there's variables in every single thing that we do. We have to make sure that we take dogma out of everything. There has to be a place where we can have conversations like this. It's part of a critical thinking.
And still take that insight and learn from it and not letting, like, the emotional aspect of it kind of like blind you to certain realities.
And I
too.
Think that the problem is that people do get so emotional because then they think they've done harm to their kids. Yeah. And so you like, that's not what we're saying. We're saying, let's do better. Mm-hmm. Like, let's look at this as a place of like total neutrality and say, let's do better for our family, for our children. Let's do better for ourselves. Let's make sure that we're not minerally depleted for our next pregnancy. Mm-hmm. There was a study that came out that looked at different movie stars. And I thought this was so funny. And usually the best looking child in the family was the firstborn. Mm. And it's because mom had way more nutrients, way more minerals. There wasn't this like depletion that happens from pregnancy to pregnancy to pregnancy. It was like the prime before she continued on. And you could see the difference in the jaw structure. You could see the difference in just their overall glow. And I was like, that makes so much sense.
So interesting.
Yeah.
One thing I don't understand is why so many women have meat aversions during pregnancy if it's such a critical nutrient. I know for myself, I craved meat so intensely. Yeah. And if I didn't have enough animal protein consistently, that's when I would start to get nauseous. And that's when I would start to just feel crummy and have low energy. Mm-hmm. But I know that's not necessarily the norm. Can you speak to that?
And can I ask a piggyback question on that too?
Yes.
Like the one side of the aversion. And then you also just mentioned you had a vegetarian client who then started craving meat. Mm-hmm. So speaking to both sides.
Yeah. So I usually see the aversions in first trimester.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, truly think that first trimester is when everything is being built. So mm-hmm. all of the essential organs, the brain, like everything is being built during that time. Mm-hmm. So our body doesn't want us to be sick. Like if there was an invasion of something that came into our body, like some sort of, you know, foodborne pathogen, it would really dramatically affect our babies. And our bodies are smart to say in a sense that like we have aversions to most things during the first trimester because it just kind of keeps us safe, in my opinion. That's what I've seen. That's what I've noticed. That's my own personal take on it. Once moms start to move out of that developmental phase, out of the first trimester, I see the opposite. Like almost all of my clients are craving some sort of meat substance. It's like my own sister was a vegetarian for a very long period of time. And during her pregnancy, she was like, I'm like literally craving blood. Like I want to eat like red meat. Like I can't even describe it. And I was like, go get it. And she lives in Sweden. So like she has this ability. They have moose everywhere. So like they went and filled their whole freezer with moose. Amazing. And so I just think that the more that we listen to ourselves, but you are right. Like if you are really paying attention to your body, instead of like going to grab a bagel and like get the carb where your sugar spike really, really fast, then you get the crash and you feel like crap again.
And sometimes I would crave those sugary, you know, more carbohydrate rich foods. And whenever I would give in to those cravings is when I would feel the worst. Very vividly remember with my first pregnancy, I had a Muddy Buddy craving. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember Muddy Buddies?
The
also
snacks.
Known as Puppy Chow.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes.
So like I went to the store, I tried to like find the healthiest versions of everything, but I made a whole big batch of Muddy Buddies and I ate so much of it and I felt horrible.
Yeah.
And I told myself never again. Yeah. And I'm not going to listen to it.
And the reason you did is because of the sugar spike. So you would spike really high and then your body would be like, oh my gosh, that was not a complex carb. Mm-hmm. That was just really easy, fast sugar. Then you're going to dip really low and crash. Then when you're dipping, you just feel absolutely awful. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, like fine. Like listen to your body. If you're like really craving those things, make sure you're pairing it with a protein of some sort. Like get like a beef stick or something that you can balance that with. I always say first trimester, if you're trying to eat when you're awake every 2 to 3 hours, your blood sugars will stabilize so much that you usually don't end up with any of those crazy cravings. Mm-hmm. In our culture, if you look at the Hollywood culture, you look at most of the stars that are like on their Instagrams and they're like eating like the junkiest junk because they have an excuse to gain weight. And I remember Kim Kardashian's pregnancy, she posted this picture and she was in these clear heels and she was so swollen, like literally like her like swelling was like coming over the like straps on her shoes. And I remember saying to my husband, I'm like, oh, she has preeclampsia, she'll be induced. And he was like, stop being judgmental. And I was like, I'm not, I'm saying she has preeclampsia.
You're making an
observation. I can see that she's really, really swollen and she's not healthy. And like 2 days later, she was like induced in the hospital for preeclampsia. It's simple. Like don't eat junk. Prioritize your protein, get some salt, support your liver, and you should have across the board really good results. 25,000 people studied by Dr. Brewer with not one incidence of preeclampsia. That's profound.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Yeah. Everyone should know that.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on raw foods during pregnancy? I consumed raw liver throughout 2 of my 3 pregnancies. Had really positive results with it, but I know that can be controversial.
Yeah. So as somebody that's like a healthcare provider, I wouldn't like get on anything that would be a wide recommendation and be like, everybody should go eat raw liver and raw fish and feel really good. Because everybody needs to make individual choices. You have to feel comfortable with what you're doing. So do I tell clients that are eating raw liver in their pregnancy to stop? Heck no. I think it's really good for them, actually. If you look back to what our ancestors did, everything was locally sourced. My grandma grew up on a farm. She would go and milk her cow. She would drink the milk right from the cow. Anything that was butchered was saved. Every part of that animal was eaten. The organ meats were like the most delicious, delicate part of the whole system. Like they were prioritized for pregnant women because they knew that they were the most nutrient dense. And so you look at Japan. Do you think pregnant women stop eating sushi in Japan? No, it's part of their diet. They have raw fish all the time. They know the source of where it's coming from. They go to places or they bring it home from the sea markets that they, you know, it's good people that are bringing this fish home that they've trusted for the last 10 years within their home. Would you go to like some round table sushi restaurant in the mall? No. You know, you want to make sure that no matter what you're putting in your mouth, that it's from a good source. So with everything in life, there's going to be inherent risks, and you have to be comfortable with those risks. You could get in a car and get in a car accident. Does that mean that you stop driving? No. But when you take responsibility for what you're doing in your life, then you get to go through those inherent risks and see what's beneficial for you. Is that raw liver beneficial for me? Yes, I'm willing to take that risk. And then you actually move away from what the Western medical model is of putting your trust in somebody else. You get to bring back that inherent trust to yourself, which I feel like is one of the most important things that we can be doing right now in medicine.
Let's back up a little bit. I want to talk about your birth experience as a first-time mom and how that influenced the rest of your life and your career path.
So when I got pregnant, I was young. I was 21 years old. I worked in a hospital setting. I chose what the standard hospital route was, not because I didn't have this desire within me to have a natural birth. I did. I took childbirth classes. I really went outside of what the standard was at that time. But I was with a standard Western medical doctor who practiced obstetrical medicine. When I was a day before my due date, he said that my baby was measuring too big. He put the fear in me that my baby might not be able to be born vaginally. At that point, I didn't really know any other difference. So I went along with the recommendation of being induced. I had every medical intervention you can imagine during this induction. We call it the cascade of interventions. So during this time, I ended up with a C-section after 18 hours of Pitocin, after my water was broken. During my C-section, I had epidural anesthesia that wasn't placed properly, so I actually felt most of my surgery. So I had an experience where I gave birth, but in the same sentence, I also thought I was dying from the pain. I asked to be put to sleep. The doctors didn't believe me that I was feeling pain. Then they started pinching a part of my body, asking me where it was, and I said the exact place that they were pinching. So as I came out of anesthesia, obviously the most important thing was that I wanted to see my baby. I wanted to make sure that my baby was okay. But I had this deep underlying sense that something was wrong and that I was robbed from an experience. It's a sacred rite of passage. There's no way around that. Any way that we look at it, there's gifts that are given during this process. There was just a quote recently that said, during pregnancy, we stretch. During birth, we shatter. And during postpartum, we put all of the pieces back together. So in my postpartum, putting all these pieces back together, I realized that in missing out from this sacred rite of passage, what was, I said, stolen from me, I became a savior. I wanted to save everybody from having the same experience that I had. And I got into birth work within a year after my daughter was born. I was a doula in the hospital. I had witnessed hundreds of doula hospital births. I became a lactation consultant. I saw thousands of babies that were in the hospital for breastfeeding problems. And what I realized is that you really can't save anybody. They have to want to find their strength within it. They want to, if they want to have those experiences, it has to be within themselves. And during that, I realized the best way to do that was provide a place for women to have the voice to do that, to have individualized care. And I became a midwife. So in the process of midwifery school, I got pregnant with my son. He was born at home in my jacuzzi underneath the stars, and I had a completely different experience outside in the middle of summer. But both experiences were equally as important for me, because had I not had the experience of my daughter, I wouldn't have even had the drive to look into basically my whole life's dedication to women and every family that I serve. So it's really interesting, you know, these sacred contracts, we have to look at them and really take them for what they are and allow ourselves to be moved by what experiences we have.
For anyone that's unfamiliar with the differences between a traditional OB and a midwife, can you kind of break that down for us?
So it's different models of care. So the obstetrical model of care is basically where they look at pregnancy as an emergency waiting to happen. So anytime that there, you know, something comes up, it could be a potential emergency. Where the midwifery model of care really looks at pregnancy and birth as the most normal physiological process there is on the planet. We've done this for all of time. We wouldn't be here as a species if birth didn't work. And so we have similar training in a sense. Obviously, I'm not a trained surgeon, although I can stitch very, very well. And I can do things within a scope of practice that it's not involving surgery, but we do have a lot of very similar skills. I don't have an anesthesiologist at home. We're not providing any sort of medication for moms, any sort of pain medications for moms. Although if a mom desires some sort of antibiotic for a positive status of group B strep, we can provide stuff like that. We have, in most states, we have available to us anti-hemorrhagic medications, which are to help minimize postpartum bleeding. Very rare that we have to use it, but it's something that we're so, so grateful that it's available to us if we ever needed to do that. We are able to provide the same level of care for normal low-risk women. So if a normal low-risk woman comes to me, I can see her throughout the entire pregnancy process without her ever having to facilitate care from a doctor. Obviously, every state's going to be a little bit different, but I can draw labs in my office. I can refer for a diagnostic ultrasound. If there's something that comes up that's maybe a different level of care, I can make referrals to maternal fetal medicine doctors, which usually do co-care with me and try as hard as we can to keep those patients in care together, making informed decisions along the way. But you know, it's pretty similar. Like I would say, I bring a basic labor and delivery room to the home.
I was just going to say that. I think my midwife, Lisa Marie, who you know,
I love her,
told me that they bring maybe it was even more equipment into your home than they have in a basic room in the hospital. Mm-hmm.
Depending on what grade of hospital it is.
Okay. Yeah. But that was just kind of like a light bulb for me, because I think a lot of people think of midwifery and home births as this woo-woo, hippy-dippy, mm-hmm. kind of thing, but really there is a lot of medical components to it.
And we're trained in normal physiological birth. If you were to ask most OBs if they've witnessed a normal, non-interventive physiological birth, chances are they would say no. So, you know, when you look at, if you look at like FEMA, like if there's a natural disaster, the people that should be writing the protocols for out-of-hospital birth should be the midwives, because they're experiencing normal physiological birth. Where is in an emergency situation, an OB wouldn't even have access to a lot of those tools that they use within the hospital setting. And so it brings it back to the basics time and time and time again. You just look back to the basics, which I think is what we're all trying to do with everything right now.
Yes.
Our food systems. Yeah. Let's go back to the basics with our air. Let's go back to the basics with our water. Like, let's take all the crap that we've put in our water. Let's look at fluoride. I mean, we just had a recent ruling that says fluoride's bad for us. Yeah, of course it is. We've in the natural health world, we've been talking about this forever.
No, that's another thing that contributes to low testosterone, right?
Yeah, it's one of, I mean, it also decreases your IQ.
Wow.
So we have to look at, like, what are we putting in our systems that we could so easily take out that would make such a substantial difference with the health of the human race?
Yeah, we have to really question all of these things that we have just taken as being normal.
Yeah.
And really evaluate, like, is this serving me and my family,
yes.
or is it not?
Yes.
And make decisions based on that.
Very simple question. Very simple question.
Yeah, one thing I love about home births too is that in the home setting, it's just so comfortable and peaceful, and it really allows that natural physiological process that you're talking about to happen versus the hospital setting with the fluorescent lights, the
strangers,
the noises, the strangers, the different people coming in and out. I mean, if you look at animals in the wild, like I've seen it plenty of times on the farm, they kind of just go somewhere private to give birth, like away from all of the commotion. And I see like human birth in the same regard as like, I just kind of want to, every time I've had a child and given birth, I've just wanted privacy and I've wanted a peaceful, like the most peaceful environment possible.
Yeah.
And that has what has allowed that process to kind of flow naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that you can't have a great birth experience in a hospital setting, but there's just a lot of things that are kind of set up against you.
It's apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. I always say that. Like, you can't say a natural birth in a hospital setting is the exact of what a hospital or a natural birth would be in a home birth setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's two completely different things. You're stepping into somebody else's space. When you're in your own space, you're comfortable. It's where you make love. It's where you poop. Like, these are like normal physiological functions that people don't think about, but birth is one of the most normal physiological things that happen to us. So you have to think about, if you are on a bed in a room with fluorescent lights and there's people watching you, could you have an orgasm? You know? And so,
and the sphincter muscle too, like you can't poop in front of other people.
No.
Like, that's,
I mean, if someone walked in and you were like going to the bathroom, you would automatically cinch up. Like, this cervix is a sphincter muscle. Like, it closes when you don't feel safe. So,
and what is, you mentioned something before about how long, like, depending on how many extra people are in the room, it can put a long labor by a certain amount of hours per person. Or
yeah, so
like
one of my favorite OBs is a OB in France, and he grew up on a farm. His name is Michel Odant. He's probably in his 90s now. And he says, always in his French accent, for every extra person you have in your labor room, you add an extra hour. And I say, for a first-time mom, it adds extra 2 hours for each extra person in the room. And that is people that are observing you. Yeah. If it, that doesn't include the midwife team. Like, they're there to help you. There's a purpose for them to be there. But for the observations, it definitely adds time to your labor for sure. And I really think, too, it creates a lot of complications postpartum. Like, I will never let a bunch of people come into the room until the placenta's out. Like, that's still part of birth. Like, we still have to protect that space. And if we don't protect that space, we're going to increase our risk of having postpartum hemorrhages.
And one of the things that I know you have done for postpartum hemorrhages is you will give the mom a little bit of her own placenta to kind of chew on.
Yeah. So it's not for the faint at heart. But typically when a mom is bleeding a lot, it's one of the best medicines that we have. I think our ancestors have probably used it for all of time. If we look at any mammal that gives birth, they eat their placenta once the placenta comes out. It's part
How does that work? And how does it stop the hemorrhaging?
So it's from all, it's all of mom's natural hormones that are already, it's bioidentical hormones for mom. So it's full of oxytocin. Oxytocin is known to contract the uterus.
Okay.
It's full of iron. It's full of stem cells. All of these things will help contract the uterus down. I told Courtney a story once of a client that had a complication of pregnancy. I sent her to the hospital. She didn't even know she was in labor. I was sending her in for blood work, for stat blood work. And she got into the hospital. She was 9 centimeters. She gave birth like about 30 minutes after getting to the hospital. Her husband wasn't even in the room because everything happened so fast. And the condition that I was worried about was actually true. And she started hemorrhaging, like significantly hemorrhaging. And she called me and she's like, I don't know what to do. Like, you know, like they're saying that like I might have to go in for surgery. And I said, is your placenta out? Yes, it's out. I want you to take a piece of that placenta and put it in your mouth right now. And she said the staff looked at her like she was like crazy. Like they had, like she was an alien or something like that.
Oh, I'm sure.
But it stopped her bleeding. And then they were all like, oh my gosh, like, wow, something like that happened. And I actually have a friend that's mom was in the hospital at that time. And she said, oh, that sounds like something Lindsay would do. Was that one of your clients? And I said, yeah. And she said, they actually talked about it for a while because they were all so blown away that the medicine was actually right there.
Wow. Yeah. Do a lot of your clients eat their placentas?
They usually don't eat it raw. They'll usually do it in some sort of capacity, either with mixing it with the smoothie, which would be raw, or they'll desiccate it and they'll put it into capsules of some sort.
What about the tincture?
Tinctures are great too.
Yeah.
It preserves it for a lot longer.
This is such an exciting time to have this conversation with the three of us here because Courtney is newly engaged.
Yeah.
And so, and they want children. And so I feel like all of this stuff is probably, I mean, maybe not quite like something that you're thinking about super deeply yet, but maybe it is. And you're also a doula. Like, you have so much experience.
We did.
I got to take Lindsay's first doula immersion last year, and Lindsay was my sister's midwife, and so I got to be present for that birth.
Isn't that cool? There's so many connections, like with that, and then with Lisa Marie and you being close friends. Like, it's very cool. What are some things that are? We haven't even talked about this like offline yet, but I'm curious. Like, where are you at with birth? What kind of a birth do you want? What are some things that you're still kind of like wrestling with regarding birth?
Honestly, you guys, before my sister had her baby in 2019, birth terrified me, which I also think your message that you're sharing with the world and with women is so profound and powerful, and we need to hear it because of this is a natural process for women. It's a divine process for women. And I feel like we've been indoctrinated and ingrained with this fear-mongering mentality. And seeing my sister go through a natural home, unmedicated birth, and then she made me watch this documentary by Ricky Lake called The Business of Being Born, which completely transformed my perspective.
Did you like that one?
Oh, it's one of the best ones out there.
It's so good.
I watched it actually create a tidal wave in the birth world. Like, it really shifted people's perceptions.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Completely shifted my perception to birth is beautiful.
Yeah.
Women are badass, and our bodies were created and designed to do this. And so then going through your doula training last December, it really just opened my eyes even more to the beauty of birth and to really lean in and surrender and how you really take this holistic approach and how mental it is and how emotional it is. Because I think physical pain has always been my worst fear. Mm-hmm. So birth, when I would think about becoming pregnant, I was like, oh shoot, there's only one way out for this baby to get out. Like, this baby has to come out one way or another. And that really scared me. Yeah. And now just learning alongside of you and even being a part of the Primarily Pure team and this holistic approach to living and all the resources and tools we have to optimize our experience and really surrender and just experience a really beautiful birth excites me. Yeah. And I actually, going through the doula training program, I did realize as I was going to begin observing births that maybe birth doula is not my calling, because the on-call life is a bit like, bless you for being on call. Like, yes, that is not for the faint of heart. Yeah. And like dropping everything in a minute to be by a woman's side. Yeah. But I'm really drawn to the postpartum side.
Yeah.
And that recovery and replenishment and nurturing. Yes. And I feel like the fourth trimester is often overlooked.
Yes.
There's such an emphasis on pregnancy and birth and labor, but the postpartum to help that mom reestablish that foundation for future children. And like what you were saying, like the firstborn has those nutrient stores and that solid foundation. So wanting to maintain that first.
Yes.
I'm just deeply blessed by you, Lindsay, and this movement that you're really leading. And I think that more and more women are going to be blessed by your message to step into their power, to feel embraced, embodied, and empowered. And like really tuning into that innate wisdom and that great grandma wisdom that you often talk about. And I feel like we can live quite disconnected from the generations before us. And I feel like reconnecting to our mothers or grandmothers and then thinking more with our legacy and the children that are going to come after us is a really powerful perspective.
Yeah. Yay. I received that. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So beautiful. I'm very blessed by you. It's just such an honor to be sitting here with both of you guys and having this conversation. One of my prayers on the way in driving to the farm was that this message is received by everybody that needs to hear it, because I feel like this movement can really make a significant difference on the earth.
Yes.
I really think that we can bring everything back to like the roots and get back to the core of the essence of what human nature is, which is living simply, like living by our hearts and really being in the space of moving through these sacred rites of passage to give us the gifts that we need for each step of our life.
Mm-hmm. There's a book you had us read in our doula training, and one of the quotes that stuck out with me was, "Peace on earth begins with birth."
Yeah.
It's really stuck with me.
Yeah. Lovely.
That's really cool. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I mean, having experienced birth three times now, like natural home births, it has been such a transformative experience.
Of course.
Every time.
Yeah.
In different ways. But I think the main thing, it's really empowering. Like, I always post-birth just feel like so proud of what took place, like proud of myself, proud of the baby, the bond it creates between the two of us. It's like, makes me want to cry just talking about it. Yeah. It's amazing.
It's amazing. I have to read this. I got a text message last night from a client that has had four babies, and hold on, it came through like literally right before this. So, looking at this baby nursing on my chest, I watched my birth videos again and again. I feel overwhelmed and in such deep gratitude. This birth healed parts of me that I didn't even know were broken. Mm-hmm. It ignited a fire with me that I didn't know was there. Thank you for holding space and providing the guidance and care that gave us our story. This has truly changed my life forever.
Wow. That's so perfectly said.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sums it all up.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Courtney touched on something that I've always been curious about with midwives.
Yeah.
So obviously you're on call, you're having to, you know, work odd hours, up all night, like all the time.
Yeah.
How do you still take care of yourself and prioritize your own health while showing up for moms in that capacity?
Yes. I think that this is like an ongoing question that I continue to ask myself because it continually evolves. The average lifespan for a midwife to have a career is 7 years.
Wow.
I'm going on 20.
Wow.
So I constantly am needing to find what nurtures me the most. One of the most important things that I do for myself that I prioritize is I try to prioritize always making dinner for my family when I'm home. Mm-hmm. Sitting around a table with my family is one of the most important things for me. And the second is making sure that I get outside and walk, like, you know, get my steps in, as everybody says. But I have a beach path that I walk. I try to walk it every single day. And doing that has made such a significant difference within my health. Mm-hmm. It grounds me. It nurtures me. I am able to breathe. I'm able to be in communion with God on those walks. Like, it's just one of those things that, like, it's almost a non-negotiable unless I'm at a birth. And if I'm at a birth, I still try to get outside and walk if possible.
I'm the exact same way.
Yeah.
Walks are my jam. Oh. I have different biohacking devices, but out of everything, if I could choose one thing, it would be the walks.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I have all those mats and the lights and everything.
All the stuff.
It's walking.
Yeah.
It's walking. There's research, if you look at the CAT scans of women or of humans, that prior to a walk and then after a walk, the parts of the brain that light up after a walk is like mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. You're like, how is that even possible that it could make that much of a difference? But that's what we
meant
for
to do
all
it.
The time. Mm-hmm. We always were walking. Mm-hmm. You know, they say the average steps for humans right now on the planet is 3,500. I probably would say that's in the United States because if you go to Europe and stuff, everybody walks.
Everywhere.
But 3,500 steps is nothing. That's sedentary. The research shows that if you're walking more than 7,500 steps per day, you're reducing your risk of inflammatory disease, of bad metabolic health by 50%. 50%. That's so simple.
Mm-hmm. So simple.
Back to the basics.
Back to the basics.
I know we're running out of time, but I want to touch on postpartum quickly.
Yes.
Since it's something that so many moms struggle with.
Yes.
What would you say to a mom who's struggling with postpartum depression or just healing postpartum, anything?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that we're a nuclear society. So we've moved away from being in community with all of our sisters and our aunties and our grandmothers that would come and help take care of us and take care of our babies after we've had a baby. Having a baby is a significant life-changing event. And so what we need to do is prepare ourselves like before we give birth. We need to find our community. We need to find our tribe that can come and help nourish us. If that's not an option, prepare your foods beforehand.
Yeah.
Make sure that you have really nutrient-dense foods that you can get out of the freezer and pop in a pot, warm it up, and then you have food for your family all day. Making sure that you stay in a place of being not depleted is huge. Making sure that even in between nursing your babies, that you're prioritizing rest and not running around like our Western society promotes. I really, really like what Eastern cultures do. It's 40 days in bed. Western culture, there's moms that are outside running around doing errands at 2 days postpartum. We need to be in our houses. I say 5 days in bed. That's non-negotiable. 5 days in bed. 5 days around your bedroom. And then 5 days around your house. If you give yourself 2 weeks of rest and recovery, you're gonna have a completely different postpartum experience than the majority of people in the Western world. Women need to prioritize themselves. We just gave birth. We just had a life transformative event. We're bleeding. Mm-hmm. We're recovering from our bodies being stretched. Mm-hmm. Remember what I said, at birth you shatter and postpartum you put those pieces back together. So we need to be able to create a space where those pieces can come back together.
Yeah, it's so simple and so powerful and yet so hard in our culture today. Even for me, like knowing all of this going into birth, it's still a struggle. Just being still and like doing much less during that time, but it is so important.
Yeah, it is.
The times that I've prioritized it more,
you feel so much better.
So much better.
Yeah.
Lindsay, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah,
this was such a treat. Where can people follow along with you, learn from you, connect with you?
My Instagram is a really good one. It's just my name at Lindsay Milas. And then my website is theremembering.com.
Thank you so much.
Yes, Lindsay, thank you.
Love you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
Yeah.